This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, originating from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. Your number is 877-217-5757, 877-217-5757. Emails are directed to talk@talklouisiana.org. Renee Martin and Robin Dow producing, and in the house to begin is Hiller Moore, the district attorney for East Baton Rouge Parish. Much ground to cover with him. Yesterday, front page, EBR district attorney seeks more funding, money sought to combat staffing and workload woes. And it's been a case in which there are 15,000 active cases, is that right?
Correct.
And you have limited resources.
Sure, like I'm sure everyone in city parish government feels they have limited resources, and we surely do, particularly given the type of staff that we have, professional staff, lawyers, investigators, analysts.
What can be done?
That's a good question, hard answer. I wish we had a money tree that we can just shake and
it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way. So I don't know. I think that we just have to figure out what our priorities are and put the money where the priorities are. And I think that public safety should always be number one. I do also think that we're the capital city, and we probably are in the rank of assistant DAs and offices. We're the third in the number that we have.
And we have, Orleans has more people.
We have more people. Orleans has around 90 assistant DA slots. Baton Rouge is given, I think, 54, if I'm not mistaken.
So we have two-thirds, a little less than two-thirds.
And I think Jefferson Parish has more than we do, and maybe one other.
We're the biggest parish.
And so we just can't keep up with the numbers, and it seems that Orleans gets all of the attention and all of the money, and we do not. So we just cannot keep people. We have talented staff, dedicated staff, that need raises, want raises just to keep up, and it's hard to do that.
Well, is there a tax?
Yes.
That would work?
It's so distasteful. We thought about this for a long, many different times. It didn't pull the trigger on it, but we thought so many times about a tax. We can call our own tax, probably a property tax, but it costs money to do that. So it's an election. It's $200,000 to do that. The public defender needs money. We need a jail. We need a prison. Courts need money. You know, do you do it alone? Like Tony Clayton did it alone, and he was successful. He's now has a fully staffed office
in West Baton Rouge,
a lot of money. So I want to be a team player, but I need to take care of my people. They're desperate on wanting to just be adequately paid, not even more than what they deserve, a lot more.
Well, and a listener notes under fire at times, unjustly, even by some of the people on the bench.
I don't know if you want to touch that, but... Yeah, so look, I'm mindful that you don't want to overstaff the DA and not staff the public defender. I'm mindful that we need to do this in an effort together. We should be staffed differently, but it should be adequate.
Well, you do prosecute a lot of people, and,
yes,
and usually they are successful, and I would suspect that usually the verdict is correct, and sometimes you lose. But
sure.
One yesterday, mother found guilty of murder in toddler's overdose death. This was in our court. It was 19th Judicial District Court, a case your office handled. What happened in this one?
So this is a young toddler, less than 3 years old, overdosed two times on fentanyl, was revived, and then on the third time of the overdose did not survive and died. And we eventually charged the mother with second-degree murder, and the jury found her guilty yesterday of second-degree murder.
Well,
Those are difficult cases.
Yeah, those are difficult cases.
The emotional cases, and we're not saying the mom was a terrible person, that she did things that caused her child to die, and she needed to be held accountable, and I think the jury saw that, and that's what they came back with.
When you get a conviction like this, and there's the next round, there's the sentencing round, how is that going?
Well, in this case, sentencing is life imprisonment. So
Automatically.
But after that, it's years of appeal. And it's, it's 10 to 20 years of appeal. Death penalty appeals are 20 to 30 years.
And when contest an appeal, and every person convicted has that option, and that's our system, and it's a good system, but... there's a cost to that. Who pays the freight on that?
Our office. We're not paid extra for any of that. Right now, I'm telling you what we're struggling with the most is not a big ticket item, but one we're not funded for, is protecting witnesses. Victims are able to obtain funds from victims' reparations, but the number of witnesses that we have that are highly at risk of being killed, it's costing our office thousands and thousands of dollars to try to protect them. Protection is really not the right word because we can't protect. We can assist them and put them in the best place they can be, but this is a problem that's ongoing currently.
Well, I've seen people who were witnesses. One time, a lady, I happened to be in the same place at the same time. She approached Tony Clayton, and he was nice, she was nice, and they were on the same side, and she had witnessed a murder. And he sent her off to St. Louis, but she couldn't stay forever. So it's you know, and she said she was scared to death to come back, and you can imagine why.
Absolutely. So it's not only the witness, but it's the witness's family. They have children, they have school, they have relationships, and how do you do that? And oftentimes our witnesses are also our defendants, and makes it even a little more difficult. So we have to report all of the money we spend on a witness being protected or assisted to the defendant that we're seeking to prosecute, you know, which is fair game.
Well, a few things that some listeners have inquired about, and Hiller walked in this morning, and usually he's here early, but today he sat down and we went, but we did talk very, very briefly about this pager incident.
Yeah.
An amazing thing in the Middle East, and obviously if something like this can be done there, it can be done anywhere, and these people who were wounded, 3,000 people, most of them have head injuries because they were looking at their pager when it exploded. This is a crazy world we're in, isn't it?
You would assume that someone will copycat this incident that's going to happen. And you know, that also brings to another thing, the technology today, talking about funds for the office. So we are a completely different office than we used to be, where we relied on fingerprint and dust and someone to look at a fingerprint. Now it's DNA, cell phone data, body camera footage. A case that used to take 30 minutes to read and review takes you now maybe 3 months. It is a challenge.
How challenging is it? We've talked about this, but it's been a few years to get into somebody's phone. You've got pros who know how to do it, but still, I don't know how they do it.
This is a subject that you and I could spend a long time on. We fought in Congress with me and the former District Attorney of New York, Cy Vance, trying to get Congress to say, please make these phone manufacturers manufacture the phone where they know the passcode and can get into the passcode if ordered by a court, not if we just want to get into the phone. It's a court order. Like, I can go in your home, your most private place. I can search whatever I want if the judge gives me authority. The judge gave me authority to get into your phone, but I physically, electronically cannot.
So Apple, you have to get these pros to kind of figure out what the passcode is or try to.
However, now the pros, the best at the business, the FBI, the Secret Service, CIA, they can only get into certain models of phones because they have not cracked that passcode. They put them on a machine that's called a gray key machine, and they just pound it with algorithms until they get in. That could take years. By that time, the case is done. You're not going to wait for years. And think about it. It could contain valuable information for a prosecutor. It could also contain exculpatory information for a defendant. And if the defendant does not give us their passcode, which apparently at this point, courts have not ordered that they do, like give us your name or put your fingerprint on the code, we have not able to get into a lot of phones.
Well, this young man who tried to kill former President Trump back in July, he obviously was dead. He wasn't around to give his passcode, but the pros got into his phone somehow.
Well, it could be that he had a fingerprint passcode or facial recognition, which is easy at that point.
So they just put it up?
Put it up to his face or his fingerprint. You can take his skin and heat up the fingerprint, put it on the phone. Or the parents may have known the code and gave them the code. That's possible. And it depends on the type of phone that he had and how old the phone was. But if it were a newer phone, there's no chance they would get into it.
Apple and other operatives, they're not required.
Not in this country, but in every other country, it is required that they make a phone that the government can get into with a court order. Can you imagine that happening in Saudi Arabia or somewhere where the government wants to get into the phone and they said, well, no, you're not allowed to. Well, what do you mean?
Well, what about the threats? And another listener asked this about public officials being in danger. We've had two attempts on the life of Donald Trump, and people like him obviously are targets for some, but people like you could be a target.
Absolutely. I mean, go back a few years, what started us on the cell phone business. San Bernardino, when all of that was going on there, that phone was password protected, and all the federal agencies with the letter alphabet numbers could not get into that person's phone, and that phone just stayed there. And, you know, without having quick access to a phone, someone else may be at danger of dying. You want to know what's in that phone, because like you live your life and do your business, it's all by your phone, I guarantee you, like I do. And so do criminals. They operate on their phone.
And it's easier to solve crimes, but also easier to organize crimes with these phones.
Both. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
877-217-5757. Back with Hill or Moore after this time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana. Hiller Moore is our guest, the DA for East Baton Rouge Parish, and your number is 877-217-5757. Next week, as in next Thursday, the 26th of September, 6 to 8 at the Renaissance Hotel in Baton Rouge, 7,000 Blue Bonnet, by the way, there will be an event that is unique to our community, and Hiller Moore is involved in this. Is related to Afghanistan's issues. Former prosecutors are hunted by criminals. They helped to convict in that country. And Hiller Moore has been involved in trying to help people out who are still there. And tell us more about what's going on and what this event's about, and some major players will be in our midst.
Sure. Thanks for asking on that. So next week we have an event called Saving Aziz, and it's entitled after a book, Saving Aziz by Chad Robichaux, a former Louisianan Marine who had 8 tours of duty in Afghanistan. So as you know, when we, after 9/11, we went to Afghanistan with all of our allies with the hope of restoring or having justice brought to Afghanistan and getting rid of the Taliban and all the other organizations. We occupied there for 20 years, and then through several different presidents indicated that we were going to leave. I believe it began with Biden, then Trump, and then, with Obama, Trump, and then Biden. And Biden was the president at the time that we left, and we had a very hasty withdrawal. And when we withdrew, we left behind not only all of the equipment that you've seen, but we left behind our interpreters, military interpreters that are paid by the U.S. government, and we left behind the rule of law employees, the prosecutors and the judges who prosecuted the Taliban members in the court that were brought to them from the battlefield by the military. We promised them no man left behind, like is the motto of our military. And that was a shame for us to do that. We've never done that before. We've always rescued the folks that we said we would not leave you behind. Chad Robichaux organized a group and rescued 17,000 interpreters to different countries to safety.
17,000.
17,000. And he will be our guest speaker along with the interpreter, his interpreter, Aziz, that he rescued. They now live in Houston. They'll be our guest speaker, along with a lady by the name of Najah. Najah was a prosecutor prosecuting the Taliban, and she will be our guest speaker as well to say this is how many people are still left behind that are prosecutors and judges. With the rule of law that we installed, we made 20% of the judges and lawyers female judges and lawyers. And as you know, in Afghanistan, after the sixth grade, women have no standing at all or not allowed education. So we educated these folks, made them become, or had them become judges and prosecutors, defense lawyers. They prosecuted 40,000 Taliban members for terrorist acts, crimes of violence, crimes against women. And when that last plane left, as you've surely seen in the news, we have pictures of the Taliban going to the jail and releasing all of the Taliban members that were convicted and telling them, seek your revenge on the prosecutor, hang the prosecutor. And they have done that. So as we left and left the prosecutors behind, they've had to seek other countries for asylum, and they don't not wanted in Iraq and Pakistan, where they're now in the mountains living. And we're in touch with them by email and trying to rescue them to get them to other countries to be safe.
Well, it's Saving Aziz and Those Left Behind. That's the event a week from tomorrow night.
Correct.
6 to 8 at the Renaissance in the heart of Baton Rouge now on Blue Bonnet. And Hiller Moore will be there. He is the presenter for this. And it's Prosecutors for Prosecutors, the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. As you mentioned, Chad Robichaux and Najid.
Najid is the female prosecutor.
Najid Modi?
Modi.
Modi. Modi. Okay. Okay. 877-217-5757, and you can find out more information by contacting Sarah Bennett, 225-241-0593. That's 225-241-0593.
So, Jim, at this point, 57 of the prosecutors have been killed. We have the pictures of them being killed.
Probably brutally.
Brutally. So normally what they do is to get the prosecutor outside in front of the public and in front of their family, and let them know what they're doing and why they're doing it. I mean, they have sought them out in Pakistan and Iraq, and they're targeted females. But as of today, it's 57 that have been killed.
Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Yes, D.A., do you think that the recent Supreme Court decision will extend to other elected officials, like governors, now having a defense of acting in an official capacity?
All right, that's an interesting question.
You know, I hadn't even thought about that, but I doubt it. But I haven't given that much thought. But that's I'll consider that. But I hope never to use it.
Well, you have been courted to run for governor.
Yeah.
Last year, mayor this year, and last night I was talking to a guy. He probably wouldn't want me to mention his name, but a well-known political consultant. He said you could have beaten Jeff Landry. I don't know if that's the case, but it would have been a race. You would have been in a runoff.
Probably. Yeah.
I don't think there's any doubt. And so it would have been a more contested race. Why did you not pull the trigger on either one of those? And I think you would have been.
Yeah.
I'm not showing partisanship. I think you would have been the favorite if you'd run for mayor.
I have to go home and live with my wife, but the bottom line answer is I love the job I have. I love the people I work for, not only the employees in the office, but the people in Baton Rouge, and we have a lot of work to do still, and I'm really passionate about the job, and I wake up every day wanting to go to work despite the things that we face.
Well, you obviously are really into the job you have,
yes.
But in many ways, as you've noted, it's a thankless job. You don't have an entourage.
No, I'm gonna tell you. It is. It could be thankless, but I'm gonna tell you, Jim. Wherever I go, somewhere, stores, you name it, people recognize you. Obviously, you're old and white hair. It's kind of hard to hide, you know, being on television. But black and white, young and old, people recognize you, and they come out and they talk to you, and they say thank you and thank you, people. So, it is that means the most to me.
Well, and the first time a public official gets a death threat, and unfortunately that's part of the job usually now, they go crazy because it's always serious. But you're in a situation where if you got hot and bothered or upset or wanted to go into hiding for every death threat, you wouldn't be coming out of your house, would you?
Correct. I mean, you have to take them seriously, but we don't have security. DAs do not have any security, but you have to take them seriously, but just use caution as best as you can.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Hiller Moore. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Moore, and you're really a brave man. And I would just beg the public to help us ban the AR-15 and make our public spaces safe to go out in. It's unacceptable.
All right, well, assault weapons are a different breed of cat.
Yeah, you know.
Phil, if you call back, though, we might slide you in for a follow-up on that. But
yeah.
But go ahead. Assault weapons, does it make your job harder?
Yeah, so it makes the killer, who's generally a coward, easier to kill people from far away. But really makes it even worse is the auto sear that drops into that AK. It's the small device, $30. That drops into that semi-automatic AK that makes it fully automatic, that can spew out 90 rounds in 3 seconds. And it's the same thing they make with a switch. They call it a Glock switch, but it's a switch that goes on the back of a weapon.
90 rounds in how much time?
3 seconds.
3 seconds.
Yes. It is very dangerous, but you can spew out a lot and kill a lot of folks, including yourself. But the semi-automatic pistol, 9mm 44, you put a switch on the back of that, and it extends that magazine or extended magazine in very short period of time, and it's with one pull of the trigger. It's very scary. We've seen an abundance of those. It is a felony now in Louisiana to have that switch. However, it's not considered a crime of violence, and you can be convicted and serve up to 10 years and walk right out of jail and buy another gun.
Really?
Yes.
Where there are people convicted of white-collar crimes in federal prisons who can never carry a gun again.
Correct. And so we were not able to pass. We were able to obtain the help of gun rights advocates, which we appreciated with that, but they would not go along with making that a crime of violence.
Well, we'll spend a few more minutes with Hiller Moore, but a reminder that this event is next Thursday, and for more information about helping the folks in Afghanistan, 241-0593. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. On deck for a few minutes, we'll visit with Adam Johnson. Big night tomorrow night for the Baton Rouge Symphony, and a week from tomorrow night, as mentioned, Saving Aziz and Those Left Behind at the Renaissance. This is to help those in Afghanistan who, of course, are being terrorized and killed as a result of what's happened in that country with the Taliban taking control. And again, more information, 225-241-0593. But Hiller Moore has now been DA for 16 years. But you'll, by the time you run for election, it'll be 18 years.
Yes.
Six-year terms, right?
Right.
So that would mean that you'd have to commit to a time when some folks are calling it a day to run again, or are you planning on running again in 26?
Oh, absolutely, running again. I love the job I have and the people I work with and for.
Well, it's rare to find somebody with a job like yours who really likes it. In fact, I would say most lawyers don't really like practicing law, but they enjoy the people they're with and the income it provides and the lifestyle that is available. But it's a tough job, and being a prosecutor is, I think, even tougher.
It is, but it's the reward you get for helping the victims and giving people second chances.
Well, we're glad you're in the game, and we're glad you stop by here every now and then.
Thanks, Jim. Go Yankees.
Go Yankees. Phillies have best record in baseball, by
they
the way.
Do.
And your neighbor, Aaron Nola, yes. He's struggling right now. We got to get him ready for the playoffs.
He'll be there.
Okay. The Baton Rouge Symphony is thrilled to announce an extraordinary concert featuring the world-renowned pianist Olga Kern. And this will be under the baton of the acclaimed conductor Adam Johnson, who has now taken control of one of the great entities in our community, one of the artistic treasures in Baton Rouge. And tomorrow night, 7:30 to 9:30 at the River Center at 300 St. Louis Street, Adam will be there with some of the finest musicians in the whole wide world. And good morning to you, Adam Johnson.
Good morning.
Well, I'm glad. This is 3 years now.
I just finished my first season as music director, starting the
second year. But you, of course, came, as we know, from a place far away, kind of far away, to come to Louisiana.
Yeah, I'm based in Montreal, and it's always such a pleasure to come down here. And I've really enjoyed getting to know the community, getting to work with the musicians on a regular basis. We're really building a wonderful relationship and a wonderful relationship with our audience.
Well, Adam Johnson is getting rave reviews as a conductor. And some people believe a conductor is just window dressing, but a conductor really sets the pace and the stage and everything else for what happens, doesn't he, or her?
Yes, that's right. He or she really sets kind of the energy of the group. And so, of course, there's the concert where people see the conductor up front and see the musicians, but to lead to the concert, there's a rehearsal process and there's choosing the repertoire that we're going to play during the season. And so there's a lot more behind the job than just what happens on stage during the concert.
And Olga Kern is one of the best.
She is. She's a world-renowned pianist, and she's particularly known for Russian repertoire, the music of Rachmaninoff, which is what we're going to be performing tomorrow evening. And so there was even a film, actually, the movie Shine from the 90s that was created around this, the legend of Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto. It's just one of the most difficult concertos in the repertoire, also one of the most beautiful, one of the most dramatic. Mm-hmm. And she is one of the foremost interpreters of this piece. And so it's a real thrill to have her here in Baton Rouge performing.
Well, she lives in New York City. She is a Russian-American, born in Moscow, I understand.
That's right. And actually, we have two Russian composers on the program tomorrow night that both became American citizens. So Rachmaninoff and Stravinsky. We're going to be performing the music of The Firebird, which people will recognize from Disney's Fantasia.
Well, I mentioned the Baton Rouge Symphony being a great treasure, and it is. And I think one of the reasons is that we have so many people in our community who are musically inclined. They have a background in this, and some have been with the symphony for a while through a few different conductors.
Yes, that's right. There's a lot of history with the Baton Rouge Symphony, and there are, as you say, audience members that have been with us for a long time. We're also thrilled that the audience is expanding. We want more and more people to get to discover this art form who maybe haven't been before. And so we're certainly wanting to make sure that we cater to different tastes, that we make it accessible to everyone. And, you know, everyone that I speak to who comes to a symphony orchestra for the first time, they're just really impressed and moved by this phenomenon of having, you know, 70 musicians on stage playing in harmony.
877-217-5757 if you'd like to reach Adam Johnson in our remaining time with him. And he is a man, it's been several months since we visited, but your musical odyssey started quite early in life.
Yes, and so I actually started piano lessons when I was 7 years old, but I only discovered a passion for music when I was 16, kind of going on 17, and ever since then it's just been really a labor of love for me to continue to pursue this musical path. I feel so fortunate now to get to work with some of the finest musicians in the world, and very active across Canada. And it's been, I'll be going on tour with the Montreal Symphony and around Europe in a few months, and as a reserve conductor for that. But I work with numerous orchestras, and really being down here in Baton Rouge, there's such a special energy. It's such a warm and welcoming community, and it's a thrill to be here.
Well, it's tomorrow night, as in September 19th, 7:30 to 9:30, River Center Theater, brso.org. I think there are some seats available.
Yes, there are some. They're going quickly, and so we encourage people to visit the website, come check us out, and it would be lovely to meet y'all at the concert.
There's a question from Trina asking about the venue. You've performed in some of the greatest in the world, but how is the River Center, how does it compare with some of the great places you've been on stage?
Yeah, it really is a great acoustic. So the hall is designed so that the sound of the orchestra reaches you no matter where you are. There's no such thing as a bad seat in that hall. And so it's a beautiful space to perform in.
Well, again, brso.org, and you can see Adam Johnson and one of the great performers in the world, the fabulous pianist, Russian-American Olga Kern. So congratulations on bringing her to the community, and let's keep talking. I know you've got some big things coming after Olga.
Yes, that's right. We've got a very exciting season ahead, so check us out.
Well, let's bring you back.
Thank you, Adam.
Thank you. And we're joined now by Marc Morial, the former mayor of New Orleans, who's been head of the National Urban League for a generation, and he'll have a gentleman I'm sure many are familiar with, T.L. Hayes from the Black Entertainment Media Group. But Friday is...
You're right, I'm sorry.
Pardon?
Going live on the Louisiana Radio
Network. Well, okay,
yeah.
Well, listen, we've got some people, obviously, are handlers for Mark and T.L. who are talking. We'll make sure they're okay before I put him back on the air, please. And Friday is Black Voter Day, as far as trying to get people of color to register to vote. It kicks off in Philadelphia, and it'll bring local talent, business leaders, community activists to encourage voter registration. That's in a city that's in a swing state. We're not in a swing state, but we have a gentleman who was mayor for two terms. His father was the first person of color, first black mayor of New Orleans, Ernest Dutch Morial. And Mark, I think you're there. Before we get to the topic at hand, I certainly want to note that we lost a great one in your mother, who passed away last week.
Thank you very much, sir.
93 great years.
I appreciate that. Yeah, and she lived a great life, and we have just been so touched by the many, 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 many expressions of the cards, the texts, the emails, the flowers, and want everyone to know that on the 23rd, next Monday, at Xavier at 9:30, we are having a celebration of life, a multi-faith service at Xavier University for her in the Convocation Center, as well as on the evening of the 22nd, that's a Sunday, a public visitation beginning at 6 o'clock.
Well, as I said, we're going to talk about the Black Voter Day, National Black Voter Day, but your mother she was the matriarch, and I'm sure in many ways shaped your life as much or more than your famous father.
My mom was my confidant. She was my friend. She was my mentor. She was my role model. And she began a voter registration organization in the early 1960s when she and her friends were denied membership in the League of Women Voters. And I remember right after the Voting Rights Act was passed, very little. They were doing voter registration rallies and motorcades, marches. I remember that very, very distinctly, as a boy. So thank you for sharing your good thoughts with her and giving me an opportunity to talk about my mother.
Well, and I remember we interviewed her a few times when she wrote her book, and it's one of the best books about her life and Louisiana politics that you'll ever read. Now, Mark Morial, it's hard to believe, but he was elected mayor of New Orleans 30 years ago. He's been with the National Urban League as its president for many years now. And in Louisiana, we're an example. We've gotten more energized by national politics than local, and it used to be the other way around, but 856,000 people voted for Joe Biden 4 years ago, and he lost by 400,000 votes in Louisiana. Now, if 856,000 people had voted for a candidate for governor, that person would have beaten Jeff Landry and all the others, and it did not happen because the turnout was abysmal for governor, and it's strong for president, 70% as opposed to 35%. How do you explain that, Mark?
You know, I tell you, you made a good point. It used to not be like that. I mean, we used to get 70% turnout for mayor's races, 70% turnout for gubernatorial races. I remember the legendary races that Edward Edwards was involved in, Edwards Duke, Edwards Treen, in those days. And it just something, Louisianians' interest in local elections has truly waned. I can't really explain it, because city governments, parish governments, and state governments, the governor and the legislature, still are so influential over schools and roads and bridges. And
well, we'll be back with Mark and TL after this quick timeout. This is Jim Inkster, and you're listening to Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Mark Morial, the former mayor of New Orleans. I remember when he was a state senator from the great city of Louisiana. He's been head of the National Urban League for over two decades, and he is involved with T.L. Hayes of the BET Media Group. BET and the National Urban League have partnered to amplify the nonpartisan initiative to empower black voters to participate in local, state, and national elections and drive unprecedented turnout in the 2024 election. And that would mean people of color of all political persuasions. And a listener asked a good point. And TL, I think you're with us as well. What about the voter suppression moves that are taking place in our country? Are they a big impediment as we move toward the election in 48 days?
Yes, they are. And it's a major reason why we've come together as BET and many of the civic organizations are standing united to make sure that we are combating this misinformation. We want people to have, we want you to vote however your values align, but we want you to be excited and informed. And those are the two pieces that are most important. So for us, It's about coming together, giving people information through trusted sources like National Urban League, like BET, so that we can make sure that we are fighting some of this voter suppression that's out there.
And Mark Morial, as far as persuading people to vote, perhaps, for the first time or registered, we've got a gentleman running for mayor of Baton Rouge who may very well make a runoff and is a viable candidate, but he hasn't voted in 25 elections. Now, being a good citizen means voting and registering to vote. What do you say to people to coax them into doing what a good citizen should do?
So we have to be active participants in our democracy, and that means voting. I think we're better off as a society when more people vote. I think it's about the consent of the governed. So if you have elections where 25% of the people vote, then have people given their consent. This is fundamental to American democracy. One person, one vote, our right to debate, discuss, and vote for the candidates of our choice. I think the state legislatures across the state, across the nation, should make it easier. We should have mandatory and universal mail-in voting. We should be able to vote early if we wish. We should create a system where we avoid long lines on election day. My late mom, only trusted voting in person. She did not want to vote by mail. It was her preference to say, I want to vote, but I also want to vote early so I can go and avoid the lines, take my time, not be rushed, be able to vote early because I don't want to be nervous on election day. But I also don't trust mail-in voting. That's her choice. Where I vote now, mail-in voting is rather common. So we should have many options. It is proven time and time again that we can have safe, fair, truthful, and secure elections by voting early, even by having drop boxes. So I just think that legislative efforts to make it more difficult for people to vote under the guise of integrity are steps in the wrong direction. American democracy is a beautiful thing when we exercise it and participate in it fully.
Well, thank you, Mark Morial. Always good to visit with the mayor, the head of the National Urban League, and T.L. Hayes with BET, who is part of a group launching important voter education and registration campaigns all across this country. It's an honor to speak to both of you gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And now we're joined by Chris Colbert, fascinating gentleman, former managing director of the Harvard Innovation Lab and a global speaker and advisor on the convergence between technology, innovation, and humanity. His book is Technology is Dead. How did we end up here? Masters of scientific insight, purveyors of ever more powerful technologies, astride the burning planet that created us, and now responsible for cleaning up the mess and determining the future direction of all of life. Technology of Dead is Dead is a book that attempts to answer all these questions. It's a book with both challenge and hope. And good morning to you, Christopher Colbert.
Hello, Jim. How are you?
Fine. It's a provocative title. Most of us think technology is alive and well, but I think I know what you're getting at. And it is a great thing, and as we saw yesterday in the Middle East, a not-so-great thing. We have the capacity to do wonderful things with the gadgets and the strides we've made, but we also have the capacity to do terrible things to ourselves. What are your thoughts about where we are and why this book is an important read?
I think over the last century or two, we have unleashed two forces. One is capitalism, the other is technology, and they're intertwined bedfellows. And in unleashing them, I don't think we thought enough about what the potential unintended consequences could be, particularly through the lens of human vulnerabilities and human, call it unhealthy human tendencies. And technology Well, to the point about what happened in the Middle East, I think there's a presumption that all innovation is good innovation, that all technological progress is good progress. And I think what we increasingly realize is it does tend to carry these unintended consequences that we have a responsibility to try to mitigate. And the we, and this is the point of the book, is not governments. The we is actually us. And I was listening to your earlier interview about voting, the need for you know voters to vote. And I think that's an example of we have a responsibility to step forward and voice our opinions about the need for greater stewardship of all innovation, but particularly technological innovation.
And one of the principal ideas presented in this book is that we're one planet, which means we're all in this together, aren't we?
Exactly. I talk a lot about the unintended consequences through the lens of existential threats. And climate is a threat. Nuclear is a threat. Negative population growth is a threat. Cyber warfare, what you saw in the Middle East, what we read about in the Middle East yesterday, is a threat. And all of those threats don't recognize borders. They're all invisible. And I think most alarmingly, they're all actually not vanquishable. And in order to mitigate the consequences of those threats, we have to approach it globally. We cannot approach it nationalistically because the enemy doesn't acknowledge borders. And that I know is, you know, for many is like, whoa, how are you mm-hmm. going to do that? And I don't actually know how we're going to do that. All I know is we have to call it out as the truth. That we need a global effort. I mean, look at how we responded to the pandemic. We responded to it in very nationalistic ways. And subsequently, it was, you know, the pain and suffering and loss of life was greater than I think it needed to be.
You have a great quote from Einstein in the chapter Decoding Humans. It has become appallingly obvious that our technology has exceeded our humanity.
Yep. And I think that is I'll just call it naivete and or our reluctance to dig into the truth of us. One of my favorite expressions is it's easier to write technological code than it is to decode humans.
Huh.
If you look at a lot of the issues in the world, it's a function of the people involved with the issues, trying to solve the issues, not digging into the truth of humanity and how we might respond and what our predilections are and what our vulnerabilities are and what our biases are. We jump right over it and assume that the coded technological solution will somehow magically solve the problem when in fact it's the human code that needs to be rewritten.
We're hearing the voice of Christopher Colbert, former managing director of the Harvard Innovation Labs. His book is Technology is Dead. And some of this is, of course, new wave technology, but some old school ideas. I remember when I was a high school student in the late 70s, I was presented in psychology class with Abraham Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs. And there it is in your book. And you know what? It's still relevant today.
Oh my God! I mean, I do a lot of speaking around the world, and I would say to you, in the last 7 years, I don't think I have given a talk on a range of different topics that did not mention Maslow. I also believe there's a counterpart to Maslow, which is sort of a newer perspective developed over the last 2 or 3 years, which is another hierarchy of wants, which I'll call the seven deadly sins.
Yeah, well,
that alongside the needs on the, call it the dark side of Maslow's pyramid, is another set of needs, wants that ultimately may be even more profound, more insidious than our Maslowian version of needs.
Well, I think a lot of us are stuck on number four, self-esteem needs, pride and success, and that includes many of our leaders and perhaps a few talk show hosts too. But the book is an important book from Christopher Colbert, and it is called Technology is Dead, and it is an example of ideas that you'll find nowhere else other than Christopher's book. Congratulations, sir.
Thanks, Jim. I really appreciate it.
Back tomorrow.